Welcome everyone to the Yasmin Muhammad podcast. I am really honored and grateful today to have my very first guest who grew up Jane. So Jasmine grew up Jane in India, and she's going to talk to us about that experience. I'm very curious to know about the Jain religion, as I'm sure many of you are as well. It's a very small minority of people on the planet that are Jain, so we're actually very lucky to be getting a firsthand account from Jasmine today. Jasmine, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you. It's an absolute honor to be able to talk to you. And I think I told you that this is going to be the first time I'm talking in a public, forum kind of about this. So it's going to be interesting, for me too. And I'm excited as well.
Okay, good. Well, the thing is about because of the community that you come from, you can speak out against it, and luckily you won't have to worry about any kinds of death threats or anything like that.
Not death threats. You're right.
Yeah.
No death threats, hopefully.
But we did talk a little bit before about how there's always going to be repercussions, but we'll get to that. Let's rewind, first of all, and just talk about what it's like growing up Jane in India. So I know in India's, of course, got hundreds of different kinds of religions and ethnicities and cultures, and it's a very, very diverse, multicultural country.
Mm-hmm.
But you come from a very small minority. Tell me about growing up Jane, and then also tell me a little bit about the religion and what that means and how that made you different from your peers.
Okay. So I grew up, fortunately for me, I grew up in a city that is like the, Bombay, like it's New York. So it was like a multicultural. And also my family, so my parents were, they were not orthodox, they were not like following, everything was not like, and the Jain religion itself, I think as such, as the followers, it's people practice it to different levels. There's not like, you have to do this, this, or this, or this. But families, so I would say growing up, there was no enforcement. There was no like, you have to do this, or you, of course, for except for like things like, the food wise, you didn't eat, you didn't eat non-vegetarian in my household. None of that was ever brought in. Not it. So just growing up like that, you didn't eat any of that outside either.
Which isn't too strange in India, right? Because
sorry.
Which isn't too strange in India.
No,
That's very
no.
popular. Most Hindu people are vegetarian as well, or vegan.
Right,
even.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And then over and about that, there were certain days of the year, like suppose the religious days, where there were more restrictions on the food as well. So like my mom, for many years, she would follow like the entire monsoon season was like about 4 months. She wouldn't even eat stuff like potatoes and onions and garlic and stuff like that. And then during those religious days, there were even further restrictions. You couldn't eat anything like a green leafy veg, like anything fresh, like, so it was more of the legumes and stuff that like that. Yeah. So those were the kind of limitations. And then during those days, you tend to, stop eating by the time it's sundown. And then after that, you just have to, you drink water or whatever. And then the next morning you eat. But like I said, fortunately, the enforcement was not that big in my family. If as kids, we couldn't follow that, there was no like restrictions. No, it doesn't matter. You're going to do this. That was not the case at all. So yeah. So growing up, I was fortunate, I guess, that, my parents were more, they were more liberal, I would say. And so there were no enforcements. And again, in the Jain religion, there's not that much. There is no religious, I guess there are religious books, but there wasn't one at home that you sat and you read every day, or, you were supposed to do this. most of it came down from one generation to the next. I think a lot of it was memorized. Like my mom knew a lot of stuff that was memorized, or my grandmother knew a lot of stuff that was memorized. That, you know, there was a certain time of, you know, when they did, like I said, the religious days or whatever, when they did in the evening, there was a time before the sundown, they would do this particular thing where it was, you know, you sat in a place and, you know, it took like an hour or whatever. And they had all these things memorized. I think it was in Sanskrit or whatever.
So it's like a meditation or something, like a prayer?
Yeah, like prayers, I guess, you know. And I'm sure all of those Sanskrit words or whatever, I don't know, it's a Sanskrit language or whatever, they probably had some meaning to it or whatever. But I never learned any of it then, other than there was one basic, you know, one basic, like a 2 minute, you know, prayer kind of, that was pretty much taught to everybody. That's the only thing I know. I did not get into any of it from very early on, you know. And then as far as the religion, you know, so people, so there were, you know, there are monks, people who choose to, you know, become monks. Their life is very, very strict, according to me. You know, they wear the white, you know, like, and so there are sects too within the religion, even though it's such a small minority, you know, like a small number of people following it, but it does have under the chain, you know, like chain, and then there are sects under it, and then there are subsects under it too. So the sect, the one major sect from the main chain that I belong to, called Shvetambars, we, you know, the monks did wear, you know, they did wear the basic, like white, you know, the women and the men, but they are not supposed to, you know, they're not supposed to be using any electricity. They're not supposed to cook or anything. They are supposed to walk bare feet all the time. And they're supposed to pull their own hair out, like for the women.
Okay. Wait, you know. No, I need to hear, I need more context. Because so far the monks sort of sounded like Buddhist monks to me. But then, so I was going to ask you if there's like a connection to Buddhism or a connection to Hinduism, like it, where Jain sort of evolved from. I don't know if it even does. So I'm just asking because,
yeah,
like, you know, the Abrahamics.
They consider like, you know, the people who have reached like moksha. So in Jainism, they don't think that there is a god. Supposedly, there are human beings. Human beings is supposedly, I think, the highest among the hierarchy of living things that you can come up to. And then from there, you have an opportunity to get out of this reincarnation that you go into. Multiple times. But if all your karmas, like, so every time you're supposed to be building karmas, and that's what you're supposed to avoid. And then you get to a state where you can release all those karmas and you can reach, I guess, what's called moksha. I don't know if you've ever heard of the word moksha. Moksha is like salvation, basically. So you get out of this circle of life and death and life and death and life and death. So in Jains, they consider everything living to have what they call jeev, like life. And all of it is pretty much on an equal basis, which is the reason that Jains are so much into, like what I told the monks, they carry like what is like a cloth, kind of a broom kind of a thing. So they keep sweeping around wherever. So even the little bugs are not hurt and not killed and that kind of thing. So, and then, so like I said, there are no gods as such, but they say there are these 24 Tirthankars. And if you've ever heard of the name Mahavir, I don't know if anybody's heard of the name Mahavir. He's supposed to be the last of the 24 Tirthankars who reach this moksha. So then you're out of this chakra of life and death and life and death, and you reach salvation and moksha, and you become this infinity. I mean, I guess you reach this place of infinity. And there are supposed to be these 24, you know. And then people also say, oh, this is not the only 24. So this has been a constant. Like every time So you'll hear some James talk about that 24 is over, like the, you know, Chovy C, whatever they call it. And now we're ready to get into the next. And the other interesting part is that all of these 24 that have been so far, like the Mahavir was the last, they were all males. And you will hear some James talk about now that the next 24 are ready to come about. So now they say, oh, they're going to be two. And this time there's going to be a woman too. Interestingly
so
enough.
Progress.
Yeah. And talking when you ask about, you know, about Hinduism or Buddhism, I'm not sure whether Jains as such don't think that they have anything to do really with Hinduism or Buddhism. I think that's what I learned. So there is one god, Ganesha, that is supposed to be Shiva's son. If you've ever seen the Ganesha with the elephant snout, you know, he is supposed to be the son of Shiva and Parvati. But Ganesha is one god that during any like auspicious, you know, thing or something, he is invoked. So like in the marriage, you know, like when the marriage cards used to be, you know, given out to people. So on top of it is the Ganesha. Any ceremony is done, it started with Ganesha. So there, I guess they are
a little bit
have,
of overlap.
You know, they have introduced, you know, so even in my family, like Ganesha was fine. But I really think that Jains think they are like, they are above all of those other religions. I think they're unique. And I don't think they consider, because like I said, like in Hinduism, I think there are like thousands and thousands of gods probably. And of course, they say it's the same God in all his different incarnations or whatever. I don't know. But versus that, Jains think there is no God.
Right.
So,
that's a significant difference.
That is a significant difference. And Buddhism also, I don't think, I don't know about Buddhism, whether they have this, you know, the moksha and, you know, being able to attain this stage where you become like this, you know, like, I guess,
higher reaching, being.
Yeah. So I think in that way, they are probably, Jainism considers itself to kind of, to be kind of different.
Unique, except for the overlap of Ganesha, which...
Yeah, and I don't know whether that's part of Jainism or because of the influence of just being, you know, in those communities and all of that. They just kind of are using, you know, I don't know, as he's supposed to be the most auspicious. So in everything, he's supposed to be invoked first and whatever, you know, so.
I'm making all sorts of connections in my head that may or may not be correct. I don't know. But I'm sort of thinking of here in North America, obviously it was the Christian culture is a huge part of the culture, but also there's a lot of pagan pre-Christian things that have kind of been accepted by the Christians. And so therefore they're still part of our culture. So if you think of Easter, for example, which was supposed to be when Jesus died for the weekend and then came back, but we still, during Easter, we have eggs and rabbits and flowers and like all of these pre-Christian pagan symbols to do with the spring, because it comes around the spring solstice. And you'll find that with many of our holidays, like even Christmas, which is supposed to be when Jesus was born. But then it's also, we have a tree. Why do we have a tree in the house? Well, again, that's a pre-Christian pagan thing. So I'm thinking that maybe because you're all living in India together, there's sort of that kind of a little bit of crossover, but it doesn't mean a tree has anything to do with Christianity per se.
Right.
And eggs and rabbits don't have anything to do with Christianity, but they're still part of the holiday. Just a little bit of overlap because we're all living together, I guess.
And then just the connection with the, you know, the unique festival. So Diwali is something that is a religious, you know, like it's a festival of the Hindus, I think.
Yes.
But it's very much celebrated amongst the Jains. Diwali is very much celebrated amongst the Jains, and that's when, you know, even there's a Hindu New Year comes, and that's the same time that even the Jain, you know, which is right around, you know, it depends, they go by a a different calendar, actually. They don't go by the 1st January to 31st December. Mm-hmm. So they go by a different calendar which goes by the moon and I don't know. So
yeah,
there is a calculation that they have. Anyway, but it's around October or November. And that's when our New Year is actually celebrated. So we celebrate that along with a lot of other Indian, you know, other Hindus, you know. Mm-hmm. So yeah, mm-hmm. it might have been, I don't know, probably the connections or whatever. But yeah, Diwali is a great, you know, it's like a Christmas.
It's a huge thing.
And
we celebrate it.
That I love because you get new clothes, you know, great food, sweets and all of that. I'm like, yeah, you're celebrating life. That's great. You know, just take away all of this other stuff now.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, obviously I'm not religious in any way, but I love Diwali too. It's just a beautiful festival of light. You know, what's there not to love about something so positive? Yeah.
Right. Exactly.
So let's go back to what you were saying about monks pulling out their hair or something. What was that?
Yeah. So when they choose to become, you know, go into like, choose to become monks, they're supposed to pretty much, you know, so they are renouncing their entire worldly life. Mm-hmm. All their worldly, not only their worldly possessions, but all their worldly relationships, you know, mother, father, sister, brother, son, daughter, whatever.
Oh, my goodness.
Are like totally giving up everything, you know, and then you're going to go into this life where, you know, it's like some of the things I said, which is going to be extremely, you know, it's very, very, very rigorous in the kind of lifestyle that they're supposed to live. And then part of that, so when they're first initiated, they're supposed to pull all of their hair out, the women too. So they're not supposed to
have
any
female
hair.
Monks as well.
Yes. Mm. Yeah, there are female monks as well. Yeah. Yeah.
And they have to pull out their hair. Is it sort of like an initiation, like to prove that you are really committed to becoming a monk or something?
I don't know whether you would say that, but that's just one of the things that they know that they're going to have to do. Now, I don't know in today's day and date, whether they actually pull everything out or they get a barber to come shave or something. I don't know. But I think it's extremely painful.
Oh, yeah.
I do know that at least a few, just for the, what do you say, that you're carrying on that tradition. So at least a few are definitely pulled out by hand. So they change, the female monks are not supposed to have long hair ever. Every time they grow up to a certain length, they're supposed to, you know, I don't know how they do it in today's day and age. Because I'm not very familiar with, you know, I don't, but the males too, you know. So the males, I have seen the males having a beard and, you know, like that grows and stuff. But I don't know if there is a certain, but they're also supposed to do the same thing. So because all that needs maintenance, right? And you're not supposed to
live
a
maintenance-free
life.
Okay. Right. Because I was going to say, what is the obsession with hair in so many religions?
With the Jain religion, I think it's more to do with just break all your attachments with life.
Yeah, I get it.
I call it a death worship. That's basically, you know, it's an altar, right? Like whatever, what I told you about this moksha or, you know, this karma. Karma, where did it come from? I don't know. I came into this life all fine. Why are you telling me about some life that you're not giving me any evidence or anything about? And you're going to tell me, oh, I'm carrying over all this stuff, baggage from a previous life, which I didn't even know what I did about. But so, yeah, I think they're just supposed to give up. And the life of the monks in the Jain religion compared, you know, to anybody, it's just really, really, they're not supposed to have beds. They're not supposed to use bathrooms.
What? Where do they go? Just to... The forest?
I don't know. I think they go in, I don't know, in today's day and age, maybe they've become a little bit more modernized and they let them do a few things. But by the religion, because water, again, you're not supposed to use water as, you know, like the minimal amount to, you know, clean yourself, you know, all of that, you know. And I don't know how many pairs of the white, you know, whatever they wear, that attire. It's like a, it's a very aesthetic. So it's got no frills, no nothing to it. You know, it's just a white thing. The, you know, the women cover the their head also with that. And then they have this cloth, which is called like the mompatti, so that even when you talk, your breath is, you know, that your warm breath is not supposed to kill any, I don't know, bugs or bacteria or whatever. And then I told you about the little broom that they're supposed to carry with them. And they have a little piece of a square cloth that they, you know, they'll sweep the floor and they'll put it down and then they'll sit on that. So
that it sounds like it would be obviously really difficult to commit to becoming a monk. But as a just a regular Jane young girl growing up, you were saying that you had a lot of questions, like me, like most of us here on the call today, like most people that listen to this podcast. Yes. We were the ones that were the skeptics. We were the ones that were the critical thinkers, the ones that were questioning, the ones that didn't, you know, submit and conform easily. So what were the kinds of questions that you had that you couldn't get good answers to? What were you pushing against?
So I think that started like very, very young for me. I was probably, I want to say the earliest, I can't, you know, at this point, like I just have to like, if a question like that comes up, I'm just kind of thinking when or what. But I think it was just the contrast, you know, like I'm living, you know, in a well-to-do family. I have a lot of the luxuries in life and everything. And then you contrast this, my, you know, my life, and then you tell me that this is the Jain monk and you're supposed to bow to them and they are the moral, you know? And I'm like, why? Why? Why are they doing that? What is so moral about giving up, you know, life? You know, it can be right, you know. So I think it was very young. I might have been like 6, 7, I started having these questions. I think I was just with a different brain. And I think I'm sure a lot of kids or a lot of, you know, must be having questions.
Mm-hmm.
But and I think I was one of those who takes things very seriously. I'm very like, I'll take things literally. Like, okay, you're telling me this, okay, then this has got to be, you know, like, so I guess the questions were like, okay, you know, and so this monk, you know, like whatever you're telling me, this stuff, this is not just a fringe thing that is like away from my life, right? No, you're saying this is the moral. This is like the most important, like this is the way to lead your life. But, oh, you know, the rest of us are not just good enough as yet, you know? Maybe we'll come in another life and we'll go that path and we'll reach this, I don't know what. And it's like, no. Like, why are they walking bare feet? Like, why don't they get into cars? And why do they come to, like, okay, the food also, like I didn't mention, but the monks, you know, they cannot prepare their own food. They have to, you know, they have to come to the Jain homes and, you know, whatever is cooked, you know, like they take
leftovers.
That for their food, right? Not leftovers. No, not leftovers. It's fresh
food.
It's fine. Fresh food, whatever. And as a matter of fact, like when my mom would know, like, oh, they're coming or whatever, you know, she would make something that she knows that the monk, you know, likes. So they're not giving up everything. There are little places where you're kind of like, you know, and this is fine. I actually used to feel happy. Okay, they have likes, you know, good, you know. But the point is, so these are the kind of questions, right? Like you think like, okay, you know, why? And then it was like probably I was eight, I want to say eight and a half. And I thought, okay, you know, like, of course, my mom, you know, not on a regular basis, like she used to not go to the temple on a regular basis or anything. But whenever as a kid, you know, I would accompany my grandmother and my mom and what, you know. So whatever they used to do, you know, like I said, most of it was like memorized, you know, all of the prayers and stuff. And they were pretty lengthy. And they would do certain things in the temple and all. And when I would like, oh, so those are the things. So those give them something like this faith kind of thing, which I don't have. Like, I cannot see. So maybe, so one fine day when I think I was like 8 and a half or something, you know, the little, you know, like the small, even though Mahavir is not, or, you know, the other, they're not considered gods, but you still have, you know, small statues or small pictures of them and all at the home. I went, you know, we lived in an apartment building, and I went into the balcony. I collected all of these and I went over there and I sat and I said, if I do this and if I sit in front of it, and like, you know, maybe something is going to come up from top there. And nothing did.
Yeah.
I'm like, this is all BS.
Yeah.
This is all BS. So I, you know, this is, you know, my questions were like too many. And I'm like, okay, so you know, like, so my parents, you know, they're, you know, working hard, you know, they're, you know, like to give us, you know, kids and that, you know, like have a good, you know, family life, you know, be able to afford the luxuries and all that. And I'm like, okay, so my parents are supposed to, so they're telling that, oh, we become monks and we become disattached and we don't get any karma, but you people go into the world and you work and you build on your karma and we are going to just be parasites on that. I'm like, how is that fair?
Yeah.
How does that make anything fair and how is it right? So if everybody becomes this monk, who is going to be, who are you
Who's
going to be
feeding
a parasite
them?
On? Who are you going to feed on?
Mm.
You know, so I think it was just a questioning, you know, and like you said, you know, it's just some of us are too critical and we ask why? And you don't have any answers for me. You don't have any good answers for me. And then you'll say, oh, you have bad faith. And sure, listening to all of this, someone will say, oh, she knows nothing about Jainism. She doesn't know, you know. I'm sure there are going to be a lot of people who are going to say, she knows nothing about Jainism. What is she talking about? And then they're going to say, oh, you're supposed to have faith. You don't have the faith. I'm like, okay, I was born without faith. What can I say?
It's God's will.
Yeah, God's will. Or whoever's. We don't even, Jain, there's no gods, right?
They don't even,
I don't know whose will.
Yeah.
It's just
it was my will.
Will. My
That's
will.
Right.
I'm meant to have more karma than anybody. I'm like, okay, I'm going to burn in hell after. Good, great.
Who makes the decision about it? Since there is no God, would it be those 24 higher beings? Are they the ones that make the decision about sort of, do they get to judge whether you come back as a cockroach or come back as a human or, you know, when you're reincarnated? Or is that just the universe just
I think it's just
chooses?
It's probably just the universe chooses, I guess. This is the universe chooses. And you're supposed to, like for Mahavira, I know that he was supposed to have a certain point when he got, supposedly it's called a Keval Gyan, like he was under a tree. And I guess some, you know, literally something entered his brain, I guess, you know, like the I don't know, the sayings from the infinity or whatever, which gave him the moksha. I don't know. So I don't know who does that. I would assume it's like there are no gods in Jainism. So I would have to think that it's universe. So like what you, the question, you know. But those are, you know, to me, those are questions that we ask based on facts and evidence. Well, when there's no facts and evidence, you know, like anything goes, I guess, you know.
Yeah.
We all want to make
Well,
up whatever, you know.
Yeah. I totally get where you're coming from. It doesn't matter what story we're being told for what religion, for what purpose. There's always questions that can't be answered because these are just simply myths that people have made up for different reasons. And I'm sure they're helpful for community building and having support systems and giving people a meaning to their life. Obviously, if you believe in karma and reincarnation and stuff like that, you're going to be trying to come back as a higher being. So you're going to want to be a good person. So it's just another way of encouraging people, just like heaven and hell, you know, you want to live in heaven for eternity, not in hell for eternity. So it's just another kind of motivation to keep people making good decisions and stuff like that. But yeah, none of it, of course, is gonna be logical. But the thing that I talk about a lot and that concerns me a lot is obviously Islam is full of a lot of nonsense, right? Talking rocks and, you know, talking ants and flying donkeys and all sorts of ridiculous things like that. But I don't even care about any of that stuff because that none of that is harming anybody. My biggest problem with the religion is how misogynist it is, how evil it is towards women. And that's the thing that I speak out against the most. So That is a common thread throughout many religions, the sexism. Is there something like that in Jainism? I mean, I'm happy to hear that there are female gods and female monks, because even, you know, female rabbis and female priests and female imams, right? These are, these are things people had to push for. They weren't a part of the religion. What is it like in your former religion? Was there any kind of sexism or misogyny that you sensed?
No, I guess because of being in a family that luckily that I was born in, with my parents, you know, being pretty, you know, they were not orthodox at all. And so, and then, you know, we were just four sisters, but that was never an issue for my parents, for my father too. So we were allowed to, you know, follow whatever, you know, path of career that we wanted to, college we wanted to go to. And of course, being a bigger city, right, in India. So it was pretty safe for us to go, even as women. We could travel, you know, no issues. We could bring our friends who were boys at home, not a problem. But of course, you know, being the time that I grew up in India, of course, there was nothing like dating or, you know, you choosing your own partner, you know, stuff like that was not the done thing, you know. But other than that, my parents didn't have a problem. Our friends, you know, boys, girls, everybody, you know, and our house like was full of people all the time, like all our friends, you know, it was just like good food. We have to go to, you know, their house, like, you know, kind of stuff. So I didn't see any of that, what you're saying, like there was really nothing. And maybe a big part of that was because of the family that I grew up in, fortunately, that my parents were just, you know, very unorthodox, very liberal. There were no issues, you know, as such. But then, you know, I think there was a kind of, I think for my parents, there was that thing that they wanted us to probably get married within the community. You know, mm-hmm. that might have been a thing. Like, okay, you know, that, you know, you know, like I did not get, you know, married into the community. I got married to somebody who was a Hindu. And I think my mom was more concerned about my dad. And then, you know, but I told her, okay, I'll take care of him. And I spoke to him and like, he accepted. It took him a bit, you know, he wasn't quite, you know, prepared for that. But other than that, you know, I really, maybe more in the villages and stuff like that, there might be more. But like, yeah. I said, my circumstances were like, fortunately, A, I was in a family where not orthodox, and B, it was a big city, you know, so you really, you know, I think there was nothing, you know, denied to me that wouldn't, you know, have been to a boy.
So, great. That's good to hear.
Only there were small things like, you know, but then again, like I said, my family, my parents, you know, like we were four sisters. What is my mom going to do? You're not supposed to, you know, during when you're menstruating, you're not supposed to enter the kitchen. But, you know, especially on the religious days and stuff. Yeah, you're not supposed to. But like I said, my family, my mom and four, you know, girls, daughters, what was she going to do? So she didn't follow that. You're not supposed to go to the temple when you're menstruating. After you have a baby for a month or something, you're not supposed to, you know, attend any of the religious things and kinds of stuff like that. So, you know, you're not supposed to do those things. But in my house, like, you know, what is my mom going to do with five of us girls? Like, she's not like, okay, you know, every time you turn around, somebody's having a period and don't touch her and don't do this. Not going to be possible, right? It's not going to be possible. So, you know, there's things like that. But other than that, I, you know, more than because I look at religion more like, you know, it's not even about the Jain religion. You know, I'm like, it's like no religion. You cannot give me reasons. You can't give me facts. You can't give me evidence. And you don't talk to me about stuff like that. And then it's even the boys. So to me, this religion is just, it's psychologically, I think, is just so harmful, not just to girls, but to boys too. Mm-hmm, if mm-hmm. you start taking no any doubt. Of these things literally, if you start taking any of these things seriously, it's going to create so much of issues in you mentally, right? that you go
no
out
doubt.
There, you know, you're trying to lead a good life. But on the other side, it's told to you, no, the moral thing is give up everything, renunciation, you know, the less things you have and, you know, the less things you, you know, like you shouldn't, you know, like, so all of these things. So I think it's more of, I think it's the, if one wants to put a term, it's the, and against the entire species of humans, I say, you know, like all male, female, it doesn't matter. It's just if you take this stuff seriously, it's just bad.
I completely agree. So when did you decide that you no longer wanted to follow that religion?
I don't think there was a time when I decided that I don't want to, like, you know, follow the religion. Like I told you, when I was like 8.5 or 9, I'm like, I took all these and I'm like, oh, nothing's happening. You know, this is not. So, and family wise and the Jain religion, or maybe my family, there was never like, oh, you have to do this and you got to do that. And there was no such restrictions or enforcements, you know, put on me that you should do these things.
Right.
So I never, I wouldn't put it like, I never had the conviction. I never had the faith for the religion ever, I think. But pretty much, you know, my growing up years, like, yeah, I would attend, you know, something like in the temple or this the religious thing, you know, like your heart, my heart or mind was not in it. I was not like with full, like I had all these questions still, you know, like, okay, you know, but whatever, a little bit here and there. And then I think, you know, after I got married and I came here, you know, I was, of course, not, you know, following any of that, you know. My kids, I never taught them any of the religion stuff, you know. My
But your husband,
taught
did
my
he follow
ex-husband.
Hinduism?
He, I guess, you know, again, it was like, yeah, he had his prayer thing he would do every morning, like, you know, whatever his mother had taught him, whatever. And, you know, he had his gods he had put in a place and he would do that, you know, every morning or whatever. And then there were certain things like, you know, during the Diwali time, there's like this, so... you do the you're praying to this Lakshmi. Lakshmi is supposed to be the goddess of wealth, so that was a big deal for him. Wealth was a big thing for him. So, you know, those things, you know. And then for my kids, I have two daughters, and so he used to take them to something called like a Balvihar. So there are, you know, people in the, even in US, who do these, like, it's like a Sunday, kind of a Sunday school, kind of, you know. So every Sunday he would take them and they would learn about Hindu gods mostly, you know. It was the Ramayana and about the Ramayana and stuff like that, whatever, you know, the morality.
And
stuff.
You didn't have a problem with that? You didn't.
I guess, yeah, I didn't. Yeah, I let him, you know, like, okay, you want to do that. Like, as far as Jainism was concerned, I didn't teach him still. I didn't teach them anything at all. But as far as Hinduism, and he wanted to take them for this Balivihar stuff, and I'm like, yeah, I didn't have a question with that, you know. I mean, so, you know, and my daughter, like I was telling you, you know, when I spoke to her a few weeks back, and she was like, yeah, mom, when we went there, you know, at least we learned, yeah, those are all myths, those are all stories about Rama and all that, but at least now I know. And she's like, I don't take them as like real, you know, like, but I think they happened and they are stories. So according to her, she learned something good, you know. And then at the end of the day, I think when they grew up, it's their own thing, right? They have to have their own. It's not up to us, you know. They're going to be
Absolutely.
Exposed to a whole lot more in what they decide, you know. So, yeah, but just coming back to then, when I went through my divorce and all, like, for a few years, I actually went back to the religion. Like, not religious, to Jainism, like, you know. So they have, like, you know, once a month, they have a meeting over here locally where I live. And I started attending that. And, you know, like, I started, like, you know, oh, you know. And then maybe, you know, like, when you're going through that stuff, maybe you just tend to probably go back. So that went on, you know, for a few years. And then I started realizing that it was not actually helping me. It was just playing games with my mind. And I was just becoming the worst kind of person, that, you know, like superstitious and believing in all this BS and stuff like that. So I think about, I want to say, you know, since COVID started and all those things also stopped, you know, that monthly meeting and that also stopped. And I think I started becoming more, came back to the real world after these years, like, you know, like, okay, you know, and I picked up my ostrich head out of the sand. And I started thinking, you know, no, this is not, this is just not. So I would say, yeah, I never really was with it. So I wouldn't say that there was a point that I kind of left it either, but
Well, that's really interesting, because it sounds like, well, whenever people go through any kind of devastating situation, you know, that when my mother was going through a divorce and she was single mom to three kids, that's why she went to the mosque in the first place. She never really was religious growing up either. She was about as Muslim as you were, Jane. You know, it was very barely a part of her life. But when she went through the divorce from my dad, that's when she got sucked into the mosque, and it just, it went in a very terrible direction. She got very zealous. And I think that death sometimes can do that when people are grieving. They lean back, because religion is comforting, right? It tells you that there's something, like it gives you a story about death so that you don't feel like it's just nothingness and I've just lost this person, because grief is very difficult, you know? And so if you have a nice story to make you feel better, you want to believe it, because you will take anything to feel better. So I think there's certain times when people are more, what's the word I'm looking for? More susceptible to these religious ideas. But I'm glad that COVID stepped in and sort of cut, you know, brought you back to the true Jasmine, because it really brought you back to your authentic self. Because if you think back to who you were as a little girl before you were, you know, covered in all of these ideas, you were that little girl who was looking for logic, rationality, answers to your questions, things to make sense. You need to feel that it makes sense. You know, you can't just be told this is the way it is, end of discussion. You know, if it doesn't make sense to you, then you need to keep discussing. So I'm glad that you had something to pull you away from it. But so once you stopped doing that and you started to go back to being your authentic self again, what was it that attracted you to Ayn Rand, like, or the libertarian ideas?
I wouldn't call them libertarian ideas.
No.
You know, so I first read her novels when I was very young again, when I was probably 14, 15 was the first time that I read her books. And like I said, I was one of those people who wanted to know more. I want to understand, like, what, you know. So even, you know, in my younger years, you know, I was a voracious reader always. And I used to read, like, stuff on everything. And so during those times, you know, I read a little bit. Then once I came to this country, I had given up. Like, you know, I was not, like, my life was too full. You know, I went back to college to get my master's, and then my kids were born one after another. And so my life was too full. You know, I had my hands full, you know, raising the kids, running the house, cooking, you know, doing all of that, you know, taking them to their, you know, all their activities and stuff like that. So I didn't, you know, I didn't do any of that. Then when I, you know, when I, all of that, my kids have grown up too now, you know, several years, you know, now they're off to colleges and everything. And this was, I want to say, probably when that break started happening with my ex, I think I went back to wanting, you know, answers again, like, you know, part of it. And then I think for the last, I want to say, maybe 4 years or so, I've become really, you know, interested. And what attracted me, or what is, you know, great about her? So this, it's an entire philosophy, right? So and it's like the philosophy comes way, it's a philosophy for life, what I look at it, you know? So it's like, and it kind of goes into all of the major metaphysics or epistemology or ethics, you know, and then politics. It pretty much covers everything. And, you know, it's, it's reason, rationality, what you were saying, you know, like I'm looking for logic. So my mind is like, you tell me, then you prove to me. What is it? You know, how do you come to these answers? And she, you know, she's just not been a novelist, but she's been a philosopher too. And she's created, of course, you know, I think and she said it on many occasions that she based it off of the Aristotle's, you know, was the basis from which she has then developed some of the areas of her philosophy. So, and I think it's totally, if one wants to live in this world, one wants to live in life, then I think one has to have certain, you know, there is a way, you know. And so I think she's been able to come up with a lot of the answers, which I agree with. And her philosophy is called objectivism, is what the name she gave it. Objectivism.
Not libertarianism.
They are not libertarian. Okay. No. As a matter of fact, I think they just had a Zoom video the other day where they were, where they, you know, some of the, there's an Ayn Rand Institute, right? And based in California.
Yes.
And so they had two of their major intellectuals had a discussion on how, you know, libertarian, you know, all of those who call themselves libertarians are just so different, you know, like, and how it is different. So they kind of, and she also, you know, in her lifetime, there were, you know, she gave a lot of speeches at, I think it was at the Ford Forum since the 60s for almost like 12, 13 years or whatever. Every year she gave the speech, and then there's to be a question answer after that. So there are several places where Ayn Rand herself came out, you know, strongly against the libertarians, because the libertarian is like a big tent. It's got like anarcho-capitalists, and it's got, you know, some right wingers and some this, that, and the other. And she just, you know, but yeah.
I am not as familiar with her teachings.
I wouldn't even call them teachings. It's not teachings, because teachings gives, to me, it feels like, oh, Mahavir's teachings, kind of, you know,
right,
or
her thoughts, teaching, her ideas.
Yeah, it's more an entire philosophy, and it's, you know, and it's got facts, evidence, it's got proof, it's using your reason. And she separates, you know, how it is that human beings actually get their knowledge. She, you know, so what is our relationship with reality, you know, and there's a lot of stuff about, you know, and if more people were to read what she's written, you know, one can pick up her novels, and novels are great, Fountainhead or Atlas Shrugged. Even one of her earlier novels, We the Living, is just great. Anthem, my kids actually had Anthem, one of her novelettes, in their high school that they, you know, actually read and stuff like that. And then she's written a lot of other, you know, nonfiction stuff as well. So depending on where one wants to start, but one has to, you know, be, you know, I think our world would be a lot better world if more people at least were willing to engage with her, you know, the ideas. Then you may agree or disagree, but I think most of the intellectual kind of the academic intellectuals want to just like poof poof her, like, oh, you know, they don't want to even engage with her ideas. So
yeah. I spoke for the Ayn Rand Institute at Dartmouth University with Dave Rubin, and they gave me a stack of books, which I still have in my bookshelf.
Oh, really?
And a lot of those books that you mentioned are there. So I just have never really started to delve into her. But that, you know, that sounds interesting to me. But I will tell you, though, at the end of the day, you know, I agree that the world would be a better place if people would be more rational and logical and think and not be afraid to, I'm just having so many thoughts at the same time. So I was just speaking with a friend of mine who she's Jewish, and she's saying to me, I'm 54 years old and I've read the Torah for the first time. And books of it, she hasn't finished. But she just is shocked at how much nonsense there is in there. She's like, you know, this thing is like contradicting itself in the next sentence, and none of this makes sense. And did you know that there's a talking donkey? And then, it's great to see her kind of coming out of this, because she's just realizing now what it means to, because she's read my book and we've been friends for a long time, but now she's understanding what it's like to have been part of something for so long that you think it's who you are, and then reading about it deeper and realizing this whole thing is just smoke and mirrors, you know? It's a complete farce, and I feel like I've been duped for so long. And the thing about that, though, is that most human beings don't care.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's the, they don't care. It wouldn't matter. Like, it matters to me. It matters to you. It matters to her. But to most people, it's like, well, being Jewish just means I have my holidays with my family. Right. We have these traditional things. It means, you know, it means love and connection. And, you know, like everybody, lots of people feel that way about their religions. They've never read their holy books. Most Muslims have never cracked open a Quran. They can't even read Arabic. 80% of Muslims don't understand Arabic. And so they're just listening to what their imam is saying, and he can just say whatever he wants to them. So, and the same thing with Christians. Most of them have never read, you know, Old Testament, New Testament, nothing. They just go to church on Sunday, if they do. Most of them don't even. And they just believe whatever they believe. So they don't really care to make sense of it or to renounce something because it is illogical. So, and just, I'm going to read something here that Lois said in the comments, where she said, the belief of mythical beings in fantasy does not necessarily do harm, but it prepares your mind to accept conspiracy theories, cult leaders, and such. Totally agree with that. It doesn't, you're not a critical thinker. You cannot be, because in a lot of these religions, the more you question, it's like that makes you the bad person. You know, you just have, like you said, you have to have faith. It reaches a border where you have to stop thinking. And I think, you know, I'd be interested in reading more about Ayn Rand and her philosophy and stuff like that. But I think that most people are more attracted to just the human condition of community, and they belonging. Like tribes, belonging. We're social animals. Absolutely, like belonging.
Step away from my religion, all of this community is going to be gone, right? And the other thing is also, people think being a moral person is A, about other people, how do you treat other people, and B is, do you believe in some, you know, like, so their morality comes from religion. Those are the two things. Those are totally, both of them, if you think about it again logically, no. So to me, morality is about what I choose to do, irrespective. Others, you know, to me, my life is an end in itself. I think when I came into this world, that's when my life started. I don't believe in this bullshit, what you tell me about karma and all of that. Keep it for yourselves. If I'm going to burn, and then don't talk to me about my life after death. So, and like you said, right, most of the religions take you to the after, you know, after your death. Oh my God, you're going to like either burn, or I'm going to, like, in my reincarnation, I don't know what I'm going to be born into and when. So they talk about this, oh, life is a suffering, you know, like in Jainism, life is a suffering, you know, leave it aside. I did want to bring up a couple of things, if you have a couple of minutes. I just wanted to mention some things. I did want to bring this, because this bothers me intensely. So this couple of things. Now, this is an 8-year-old, in January, from a very wealthy family in one of the cities in India. Her parents are supposed to be very religious. They are in the diamond business and all of that. 8-year-old. She chose to take what I told, to take up the monk. To me, this is like, when you were talking about the misogyny, it's like, to me, it's like devastating. It's like, how can you, like, as parents, But it comes back, like what I'm trying to, the point I'm trying to make is, this is what the religion is doing. So the parents, all of the wealth that they're creating, this world, the good life and all of that, this is all bullshit. This becoming, giving up, renouncing everything of this, and trying to go towards this path of, I don't know what, you know, religion, that's the good. So no, our daughter as an 8-year-old choosing, I don't know what they think. Oh, wow, great. We got a daughter who has chosen to do this. Like, to me,
they're
it's
proud
just,
of her. And so therefore she's going to convince herself. She's a child. She just wants to make her parents proud and happy.
I don't
know, and
even
everybody
about
around
that.
Her.
How does she understand anything? But then you as parents are the ones who introduced her to this religion,
Absolutely.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, have you given birth to a child so that at 8 years old, she's going to go do this? Like, to me, you might as well have aborted her when you before. Why bring her into this? Makes me so, 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 so angry. And this, and another thing. So when this thing was brought up by some of the activists, you know, some of the activists in India, like, you know, brought this up. So they brought this up with the government. And they, you know, like, so in the office of Priyank Kamunga, who's the chief of the National Commission for Protection of Child Rights, to ask if the government was going to do anything about the Avanshi's case. And his office said he did not want to comment on the issue because it's a sensitive matter.
Yeah, there it is. There it is. Children being thrown under the bus because we
You know,
need to not
and
offend religious people.
yeah, and so she's sacrificing her life is what I look at it. You know, you got a beautiful life to look forward to, and you're going to tell. So it's just a slap in the face of everybody else who's out there, ambitious, working hard to make a better life for themselves. You're going to just come and slap them all. That's what Jainism is doing. And when I told you it's an evil, you know, evil, evil, evil religion, this is where I come from. Like, so this entire movement that I see now of this, you know, of the environmentalism, you know, like who go to these extremes. I say, if there's a religion that is teaching you all this stuff, renunciation, you know, don't have too much stuff, or it's a bad thing, all of this, then it's preparing all these people. So when those governments and authorities and all those dictators are going to come in and they are going to force our lives into, oh, you're not going to have a car, or you're not going to have your gas stuff, or you're not going to have this, or you're going to live into these 15-minute, you know, they're all ready for this. The Jain people have already been conditioned. You know, that's the kind of connection I make, you know. And so I say, you know, the Jain scholars will say, as a response to this little girl, 8-year-old, the response of the Jain scholars is, they say that the children, these children are spiritually gifted. Spiritually gifted, after becoming a spiritual guru, they can learn the life lessons that are necessary for them. What life lessons?
I
You
don't
are
know.
asking them to, you know, I want to give some, like, you know, use some four-letter words here. Like, you're asking them to renounce your life, and you're telling them, you know, go. And then the other part. So now, you know, just there has been, you know, so they have come across now. I just wanted to give this some context because about how evil this is. Because I think, you know, so there is this now 20-year-old girl, another woman, you know. So she will pluck what I told you. She will pluck out her own hair, always walk barefoot, and eat only what she receives in arms. She will never use a vehicle, never bathe, never sleep under a fan, and never speak on a mobile phone. This 20-year-old girl had ambitions. She, how did this all happen? So how does all of this happen? This is, they have these kind of what is called retreats, you know, the chains. So they send their kids like over summer or whatever, I don't know. And then these monks who are there, you know, so they go and live with them and they try to kind of, you know, get acclimatized to what kind of life this is and all of that. Now, these monks, you know, what do they tell these kids when they go? Once you take diksha, what's called diksha, the monkhood is called diksha. Once you take diksha or renounce the world, your level of spirituality, social standing, religious standing becomes so high that even the richest man will come down to bow to you, you know. And then what they tell these kids, you know, like, oh, you know, now this world, like this world is all, you know, there's too much suffering,
meaningless.
Too much is, you need to just give up all of this, you know. And where there used to be like 15 or 20 people taking this monkhood every year, like in India, now they said the numbers. So there is this Indian scholar of Jainism, I think, you know. So he's talking about where the numbers, like these numbers were from 2019. And he said those numbers from 15 to 20 had gone up to 250 to 400 people.
Wow.
So there are more people wanting to go this path. But I can see, I can understand where these monks, you know, whoever are these people, right? They need the next generation to come in, right? To continue this kind of, you know, this stuff. And where are they going to get if there are not more people who are going to, whom they're not going to attract in? And I say, who is this monk over here? Yeah.
Yeah. It just seems like everything is becoming more extreme. All of, not just the religions, but even the secular, you know, secular religions, we'll call them too. Like everything is becoming more extreme, extreme, extreme. When you were talking about that 8-year-old girl giving up her life and nobody wanting to talk about it and her family celebrating it, it's reminding
me
of in
government
Canada.
Saying it's a sensitive matter. I'm like, how in the world? And her family, like, what in the world? You know, I just, you know, it's just beyond. So I say that the other religions, you know, like, whatever people say, that is the reason, you know, I have a huge antipathy to this, you know, religion. I think it's the most evil. And, you know, what they call nonviolence is, I think, is we never talked about that during, you know, this, you know, our entire conversation. But nonviolence, or what they call ahimsa, is a big thing about Jainism. But to me, if you think about it, yeah, I'm not a violent person. I don't go there and, you know, like beat people or kill people or whatever. But that comes from the fact that I realize that it's not to my, you know, self-interest to go and, you know, like beat up someone or kill someone or anything. But at the same time, if someone is going to come try to harm me or my kids, yes, I'm going to take the gun. Yes, I'm going to take the sword. I'll take everything. Nobody's going to tell me about pacifism or, you know, nonviolence. So, you know, these are the kind of things, but yeah, so there's a lot, you know, I mean, I'm sure there are going to be people out there who are going to say, oh, she knows nothing about Jainism. But
well, that's what they do. They, when people are trying to protect their tribe, you know, that's what they do. They just, the whistleblowers, they call us liars. They say, oh, you had a unique experience. You didn't understand. You were never really Jane. You know, all the typical, I see Lois nodding her head. You probably get told the same thing by Christians.
Yeah. And if everything
you were
else,
never a true believer.
Exactly. If nothing else works, they'll say, you just don't have the faith. You need to have the
faith. You don't have the faith. You don't understand. You know, I feel sorry for you that you don't have the light in your heart or whatever. You know, but they have to defend. It's part of being tribal, right? You'll say or do anything to defend your tribe. And they don't want to know. They don't want to accept. They don't want to believe. They don't want to hear that they're also, that they're wasting their life.
Exactly.
Nonsense.
And that's the reason, you know, that I wanted to come out. And I'm so glad you gave me this opportunity, because I feel like for this 8-year-old, right? I mean, so many of them, right? And I think these are some of the better, like for me, I think, you know, those who are thinking more and thinking literally, these are probably the ones that can advance. So you, like, the amount of psychological, you know, like damage that can be done, right? If you believe any of this stuff, that everything that you do in your life, you know, every piece of food that you put in your mouth is, you know, just makes you feel completely guilty of everything. So I wanted to just be able to shine some light. And I'm hoping that more, you know, like people at least are willing to talk, you know, about this religion as well. And this is just the experience, because I grew up in this religion. I'm sure if I'd been born in any other religion, I would have been just as, you know, like anti all of them.
Mm-hmm. But it was really important for you to speak out, because You know, Sam Harris, who is, you know, one a man who I respect deeply, once said about Islam that if the fundamentals of Islam were peaceful, like then you would find the fundamentalists, the Muslim fundamentalists, would be peaceful people. They wouldn't be terrorists, right? You wouldn't see ISIS as the example of the fundamentalists or the extremists. They would be extremely peaceful if it truly Right. was a religion of peace. And then he brought up Jainism because you are known for being a very
non-violent
religion. Yeah. And it is true that, you know, so the extreme Jain would be somebody who was extremely non-violent to the point of, you said they were like caring about like even bugs and stuff like that. However, there still is danger in believing these fairy tales. There is still danger in believing, in making children, you know, in indoctrinating children with this kind of nonsense. In some ways it can be, you know, very extreme situations like what's happening with that young girl, you know, the girl can decide that she wants to give up her life. But even if she isn't deciding that she wants to give up her life and become a monk, like we were saying before, and like Lois was mentioning before, even just accepting this kind of nonsense stuff in your head, yeah, and accepting it as truth, accepting irrational ideas and not questioning them, yeah, that in and of itself is a dangerous thing to do to a child or to a human being, right? We're yeah, stunting the growth of these people.
Yes. Absolutely. And life is too beautiful for that. And life yeah, is here. Between the time you're born and the time you die, I think this
and
is
that's it.
You know, there's
yeah,
no before
it's
and
hard.
There's no after.
We have been obsessed with death since the ancient Egyptians, honestly. Like I look now at how, you know, here in the West, it's very common for, this is really gross, like, I want to be cremated. I don't like any of these death rituals. Like, I think that they're absolute nonsense. But here in the West, they do this thing where they replace the blood of the dead person with formaldehyde, and they try to keep the body in the same way the ancient Egyptians would mummify the body. They would try to what's the word I'm looking for, guys? To keep it.
You mean in the West they do that?
Yes, they do.
Put it in the casket.
No, they don't. And they put makeup on the person and they do them up like all pretty. And then they put them in very expensive caskets. And
right,
it's like this whole elaborate thing that can sometimes be really detrimental to the families because all these things cost so much. And
right,
the people feel that if they're not spending that much money on their family member, that means that they didn't love them enough
love them.
To get
right,
them a good casket and a, you know,
right,
to go through all
right,
of this, all of these bullshit rituals.
So you're saying decades and decades after, if they were to open that casket, that person would still look the same? Like how they
yeah,
kept them?
They've been embalmed.
Oh my God.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's not even like, it's not even healthy for the earth anymore. Like you're not even
right,
being good fertilizer. You know what
right,
I mean? So it's even the idea of becoming worm food is gone now because you're just poison in the ground.
Right.
So yeah, we're just obsessed. Almost every, dare I say, every religion has some sort of weird, just death obsession. And
right,
we haven't
no,
gotten over it as human beings because
right,
we just are so terrified of death. And
or
we're
after,
so,
not the dead, like what's going to happen
yes,
after, right?
Yes,
like we
what's going to
love,
happen
I
after.
Know, somebody looking up from the heaven at you, you know, like if somebody's coming to console you when somebody close to
Yeah.
you died, because so, oh, they're up there in the heavens, they're looking at, you know, they're looking, they're making sure you're happy, and they're, you know, like. But
Yeah.
At least I do think that, yeah, all of that elaborate stuff, but I do think that when somebody dies, you do want to give them a proper or whatever, you know. Like,
yes, of
you want to
course.
pay the homage to their life.
My plan for myself after I'm cremated is I want to be buried under a cherry blossom tree because it's my favorite tree. And then my daughters can tend to that tree, and they can bring their kids, if I never get to see my grandkids, and say, you know, this tree is dedicated to your grandmother. And it's something beautiful and positive, and it's life. It's a tree mm-hmm. that's growing. It's not, let's go to this cemetery and look for the gravestone. You know, like I don't like any of that stuff. I find it morbid and weird. And because I grew up in a religion that, of course, was all about death or afterlife, actually, not death. The world means nothing. Life means nothing. You know, humanity is meaningless. Yeah, it's all about what happens after. That's what you have to care about. That's what you have to worry about. Same with Lois. We were talking about this idea. Same thing with her in Christianity. That when I became an atheist and I started to renounce all of these ideas, it was a huge weight off my shoulders mm-hmm. to realize that this is life. And this is the beauty right here in the moment. And I don't have to be worried about something that I'll never understand and I'll never know and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
So it's like,
and only those special people, right? Those special people have the revelations about all that before life and afterlife, I guess.
I mean, it's a cycle. We see the seasons, we see flowers bloom, and we see trees, you know, leaves fall, and we see animals die. And why are we different? We're just part of the same cycle, you know?
Part of nature, right?
We're part of nature, and we're trying to give ourselves like these big stories to make ourselves something special and important and different. And it's just, you know, I might be a little bit weird about this, but I've always talked to my daughters about, you know, these are some, you know, I talk about like when I'm gone, blah, blah, blah. You know what I mean? Like, just like a normal thing, because I don't want them to ever be feeling like, I want them to think of death as a part of life.
Yes.
Which is something that I never got as a child. I always thought of it as something scary and, you know, unknown. But I want it to be a part of normal conversation and to not be like, you know, to have so many obsessions over it. You can come back as a ghost, or they're going to haunt us, blah, blah, blah. Like the spirits. So we have so many stories around afterlife, and it's just,
Yeah, but you're right. Humans have had just this obsession of afterlife, death and what happens after. You're not concerned mm-hmm. about life. You're more concerned about the afterlife. Like, what is this?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that's why I love meditating now, because it's all about being in the moment. And, you know, appreciating the moment, which is something that I never did before. So it is really good for my brain. It's very healing for me to just be in the moment and not worry about the future all the time, or, you know, worry about, regret the past, but just be in the moment.
In the moment, yes.
Yeah.
And Ayn Rand has added it beautifully. She has put it as the mind-body split. Soul and body split, she calls it. So she says the people who talk about the soul, and then there were the people later like Marx who tried to make it all about just the, you know, the material and the body part. So they cut the spirit, and, you know, like the spirit is one part. So all of these people, you know, like most of these religions are all adhering just to the spirit, you know, to your soul. But this split it away from your body completely. And so they, you know, they have made this, our human beings, into like, they literally cut us into halves, you know, two halves, and which is not true. Like what you're saying, you know, our bodies are here, and we are, you know, we're in this world, and we have to make the efforts to get to the values that we want to get to, you know.
Yeah. Absolutely. Did you want to unmute yourself and just say that to us, Lois?
Yes, we just had a webinar a couple of days ago. Dave Warnock spoke. He has ALS. And ever since he's had it, he's been speaking out about living the fullest today. And he speaks so openly and almost nonchalantly about dying. It's just it takes your breath away. And he's dying, but he's inspiring. So I think he's quote, living proof of how important it is to live every day to the fullest.
And we're all dying.
Yeah.
He knows it because he has ALS, so he's acutely aware of it, but we all are. We're all in the same boat, you know, and he could live a long, healthy life, or he could die tomorrow. So could I. The same is true for everybody, you know, but that's really great that he's using his voice for something so positive. Like he's turned something that could have pulled him into a deep, dark depression and turned it into something meaningful, not just for him, but for all of us to remind us.
Yeah, and he is an ex-Christian. He's an ex-Christian. He is talking about the, well, just like we've been talking about now, the evils of religion in general and how to live life. Well, like he says out loud today.
Yeah, that's beautiful. So, Nirvan or Sahara or Nazreen, is there anything that you want to... Ah, Nirvan. Go ahead. You're muted.
Still good to see you, Yasmin.
And good to see you
Jasmine
too.
As well, yeah. And this was actually was my vested interest because I'm from Bombay as well, originally, but now in Edmonton. And Sam has actually said that the crazier you get as a Jain, the less we have to worry about you. Adversely, what I did like about Jainism is back in 2016 or 15, Jasmine, you know that period very fast, Paryushan?
Yes.
Jain people actually asked the authorities and they made sure that the slaughterhouses were shut down. So, and all the slaughterhouses are run by Muslim people. I am not with Islam, but I'm with Muslim people. You cannot stop their livelihood. So this is how dark it can get.
Right.
I mean, they literally asked them not to serve meat. So their livelihood was cut off for like 8 days in a row.
Wow.
So, and also, you know, when these people become a monk, they actually celebrated so much vulgar display of wealth that it is very antithesis of becoming a monk.
Yeah, but the community,
And when we talk about the 8-year-old little kid, that's when you ask, where are these feminists, you know? Just like how in your case, if it was a white girl who would be abused, I mean, you know, social service would be here. But it was a Muslim girl, and the judge tells you that how they try to discipline you, it's not my problem. So that's how it is. So Jainism is a... I mean, like every other religion, it's a problem. There's a very famous joke back home that, you know, a guy calls a restaurant and say, I want a curry without onion and potatoes. So the owner asks that, is your friend a Jain? But like, no, he's not a Jain. He's just annoying. Also, Jasmine and Yasmin and everyone here, I invite you to read this little by Michael Shermer. It's called The Unlikeliest Cult. And how he debunks Ayn Rand in his magazine Skeptic.
Who is
so, yeah, that? Pardon me?
What was the name you said?
Michael Shermer.
Okay.
He actually wrote a book which says that why people believe weird things. And there he wrote at length about Ayn Rand. And how she made sure that her husband was a cuckold. She had an affair with his own student and whatnot. But then I want to read much more so that I can contribute. But yeah, if you read The Unlikeliest Cult in History by Michael Shermer, it's interesting.
So I have been, you know, reading stuff that she's written for a very long time. And there are a lot of people, detractors So again, I call them, they just want to smear. They know nothing and they want to smear. They have not engaged with anything that she's written. They know nothing. She was, I would say she is one of those people who is the geniuses, like just like a Einstein or a Newton or an Aristotle. She's one of those great minds. And have you, I mean, you've read Michael Shermer. Have you actually read anything that she has written? Have you read anything that she has written?
That's what I said. I don't know enough, but that was an interesting
no, so
article.
Then,
so I think
okay.
we should.
So I think it's very wrong on anybody's part to, if I read, oh, you know, somebody else says something bad about somebody, I'm not going to go on that and then talk about that. I would rather go to the source and find out for myself and make my own conclusion. And people like this, there are a dime a dozen, not just this Michael Shermer. There are probably tons of them. And if you were to Google, you would probably get a ton of, you know, different articles talking about how this is a cult and this is this and this is that and that, 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 that. Even the academic part of this country, the philosophers, the top philosophers are not willing to engage with her philosophy. I want to say, show me, let them engage with what she has written and then let them talk. Let them prove her wrong. So it gets my blood boiling because I have read, you know, and I don't need to read as Michael Shermer. There are a dime a dozen I can find people. I can Google and I can find videos of people talking nonsense about her. I want to say you engage with the ideas. I deal with ideas. I don't really deal with individuals. I don't have any concern with somebody says, oh, you know, it's nothing. You prove to me what you're talking. You give me the facts and evidence. So I think it's totally, I think people need to stop, especially if one has not engaged with her ideas firsthand. People need to stop spreading, you know, lies about her.
Yeah, I think you're right. And we shouldn't
yeah.
digress. This is Ms.
Right.
Yasmin's platform.
And just going to what you were talking about, the chains. So you're right. You know, the community is extremely wealthy. They have a lot of business people and all of that. And it's okay if they choose to do whatever, you know, you said when they become the monks and they have the big processions and all that. It's totally, you know, my biggest problem, like I was saying during the conversation, and if you got the gist of that, my fundamental problem with that religion is, again, that it is anti-life. It's anti-human life. And that is a problem. And then just the one other thing that you talked about that, you know, what they talk, you know, that the 7 or 8 days they ask the certain communities to stop, you know, what is their livelihood? And that's not true just with the Jains in India, right? Like recently I saw there was this, whatever, the fasting season of some of the Hindus up north. And there was this BJP, you know, politician or whatever. He was walking down the street, you know, with all the shops and he was telling them to shut down. Like, again, you know, because even Hindus, right, during their religious days too, they will not eat, you know. Now there's a state of Karnataka, right, that has brought in all of this. So to me, it's only when you're going to separate government from all religion, like we have the separation of church and state, you know, the First Amendment. First Amendment is not followed in India at all. There is no freedom of speech. You know, people of all kinds, right, are like implicated. There are FIRs, you know, like first information reports are filed against them for, you know, whether it's like a play that they do or like, it's a comedy show, and dare they, like, you know, like say anything about any other, you know, God or whatever, somebody else's beliefs or whatever. That is just totally, you know, like, so India is just full of that. It's just not businesses, right, on every aspect. And you have to separate that, right? So, you know, in Karnataka, like, they kill people, like, for carrying these cows, you know, like, from one place to another to be slaughtered or whatever. How can you stop? You know, you have your religion. I don't, you know, for me, it's like live and let live. You have your religion, you keep it to yourself. And the government is there here to protect everybody's rights. And if the government is not doing that, then it's coming into the place where there are going to be issues, right? And with India being with so many different communities and so many different beliefs and all that, all of the time I'm going to be offending someone. But India doesn't understand that. Freedom of speech is not part. Freedom of speech, freedom of business, freedom of religion is just not part. If I were to offend somebody, then it's very easy to implicate me and put me, you know, behind the bars. So that's just what I would have to say, you know, just separate the government from all kinds of, you know, religious beliefs, you know, whatever, you know, have a clear understanding of what is the First Amendment, what is a freedom of speech, what is a freedom, you know, you just can't do that. But yeah, I agree.
Narendra Modi is the new big brother now, actually.
I'm sorry?
Narendra Modi is becoming a new big brother, you know.
Oh, the RSS, and, you know, because that's all his bank, vote banks, right? So they play the political games, you know, I don't think they don't have any real convictions about anything, politicians. I think they just go with the whatever is the flow. Yeah, I agree. But let's just move it back to...
Yeah, let's get universal. We are getting into India. Yasmin, I'm so sorry.
Well, it's interesting for me. I've often said you can't be a politician unless you're a sociopath. I agree. I think most politicians, all politicians probably, don't have any convictions or values, and they'll just do or say whatever needs to be done or said so that they can be getting money from the right supporters and, or, you know, for their campaigns so that they can get voted in again. It's all very narcissist.
But look how vigilant is in India, killing people for carrying beef.
Yeah.
Conversely, they can eat in down south in Kerala, where it's a staple, they can eat. But in Maharashtra, from where I am originally, I mean, there are parts where you'll be killed if you have, even if they think you are carrying beef, they don't even check if it's a goat, lamb meat, you know, I mean, as long as, so that's the situation.
Yeah, but luckily, to your point, Yasmin, at least the founders of this country, America, and people just don't realize, I mean, the amount of smear and the amount of misunderstanding about, you know, what this country is all about is just so unfortunate. But I think the founders of this country had it right when they made it about individual rights, you know, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness.
Yeah,
you know,
no,
this country
agree completely.
Has been the greatest, you know, I think the greatest political experiment, and few people even understand that. And we are moving so much away from that, unfortunately.
Yeah. Yeah, when people don't appreciate what they have, they don't, you know, they're not valuing it, they're not protecting it. And yeah, it's definitely eroding. We can see that happening daily. Nirvan, were you done speaking with Jasmine? Can we move on to Sahara? I'm just not sure because your hand's still
up. Oh, absolutely, absolutely.
Okay, great. Thank you for your comments, Nirvan. And Nazreen is saying that she actually appreciated the detour into Indian politics. So thanks, guys. Sahara, go ahead and unmute yourself.
Hello, good afternoon, guys. Hi, Yasmin, and Yasmin to Yasmin.
Hi.
What a beautiful
Jasmine.
Conversation. I know. Yeah, great conversation. Jainism. I didn't know much about, you know, this religion. One of my friends is actually, she is Buddha, but I think maybe there's similarity, correct? Buddha religion and...
Mm-hmm. I think we spoke about that a little bit in our conversation. Like,
yes.
I said that the Jains don't consider that, they consider themselves pretty unique.
Okay. But are they like the monks? Are they kind of similar? Do they do the same thing?
No, I don't think so.
Because my friend, you know, her mom is like more religious. She's from Thailand. She's Thai. And her mom, sometimes, like, you know, she calls her mom on a video. And one time I was with her and her mom was waiting the monks to arrive. Because her mom cooks food, like, you know, she makes like a fresh food for them. And then they come to get the food and then, you know, they pray for her. And so is that kind of similar? I think you were talking about
Yeah,
things
I
like
think
about
that,
your
yeah,
childhood.
you're right. Probably
Yes.
that might be a similarity, like, about the food that the monks, they don't, even in the Jain monks don't cook their own food. So they go to the Jain families, and they get their food as alms or whatever. Yeah. Maybe that might be kind of like a similarity. And I think the Buddhist monks wear like the orangish kind of, I think, clothes. And they are, like I was telling, like, so in the chains, there is the top chain and then there are sects below it. So the sect that my family belong to, Shvetambars, the male monks, they do wear, like clothes, like white. And then the Buddhist, I think they wear the
It's
orange.
yellow, kind of yellow
Yeah,
or
yellowish,
whatever.
yeah, right,
Yeah, yep,
yellowish, yeah, whatever, yeah.
yep.
So yeah, they, and then there are female monks too. Now there is another, so my family was belonging to Shvetambars, and then the other are called Digambars, which are more in the southern part of India. I don't think I've seen any in like where I live, but I don't know. They don't, so I've only seen the male monks. I don't know if they have female monks now, and I don't know what the female monks do, but the male monks literally are in their birthday suits.
Yeah. So this was interesting because my friend and I had a conversation because I left Islam, right? In Islam, the segregation between men and women, right? You can't shake man's hand. Men and women are separated in Islamic culture and Islamic, you know. So I remember my friend talking about the monks. They do not touch women, female. They don't shake hands. And I'm
Right.
like, that's kind of like a cult. So that sounds like, Islam. Like,
Yeah, so the
so what
monks.
is that? It's like the one you came from, like your family, were they like the monks? Were they shaking hand or were they like, were they separated from female or
They
is
were
just.
separated. Yeah. They don't touch the females, the monks now. Okay. I'm not talking about the rest of the community.
Yep.
I'm talking about the monks. Yeah.
Yeah, correct.
So the monks, they don't, so their living quarters are totally separate, so the female monks are totally separated from the male monks. When they come for any occasion, like, when they give their sermons or whatever, again, the female monks are separately sitting, the male monks are sitting separately. And yeah, the male monks, will not touch any female monk or even
Yeah.
any female in the community as well. I'm pretty sure that's the case
Yeah,
too.
that was interesting. And it was, I know Islam is worse than Islam is more cult
Yeah,
and
because how,
misogynist.
what,
But
right?
when I, when I learned about that, and my friend was like, of course, Islam is more like, what are you, a mafia religion that pleases everybody. But then when I was having conversation with her, I said, well, how it's so similar. There's similarity with the religion. I'm not saying it's the same as Islam, but the monks are not touching females or not shaking. So it's kind of like, they keep their separated from the it was just like it was just fascinating, I to learn that from what the
Yeah.
monks do. So I was.
Yeah, I think a part of that might be also because they're supposed to, like they're supposed to be celibate, right? Completely. They're supposed to be totally, celibacy is a big thing when you take on, monkhood. So then what if you touch the opposite sex, then,
What
stuff starts
happens, like,
happening,
because in
right?
Islam
And
it's
then of
haram, so
course,
what happens if you touch a
he'll
female? Like,
jizz in his
yeah,
pants. Exactly.
I don't know if you
And
know
the other
that
thing is,
song.
every once in a while, you will get these stories, like scandalizing stories will always come up from somewhere or the other. So, like, if there is a male monk, there are females, who go in their presence. And sometimes the doors are closed and then things happen.
That's the same
And
with
then the
priests
scandals
and
come
nuns.
out, then the scandals
Yeah.
come
Do
out,
priests also shake hands? But priests do plus, like for the
No.
community. Like if you went to church, priests would, touch your head or things like that, right?
No,
Am I
yeah,
wrong?
sorry. I
No.
meant, no, you're
Okay.
not wrong. I meant the
Okay.
vow of celibacy. I
Okay,
meant
gotcha.
that they're supposed to be celibate, but Lord knows they're not celibate with the,
No.
obviously
No.
with the young
The
children
scandals
that
come
are in
out
the
everywhere. Yeah.
church, yeah, or with the
Yeah.
nuns, there's all sorts of
Yeah, because
scandals.
it's a very
Because
natural
it's human.
biological, it's a human thing,
Exactly.
right? And then when you
Yeah.
try to repress it, And obviously, it's going to show up in very bad ways, you know.
Yeah,
Just have a
that's
normal
true.
life, I say. Just have a normal
Yeah,
life.
just be a human, you
That's,
know. Just be a human and do whatever
yeah.
effing you want. I usually say just be a decent being and whatever you want to do.
Yes.
Yeah, I don't know. It's just
Don't do
very
it with underage
fascinating.
kids now. Don't do it with underage kids.
Oh, please
Under,
don't
you
touch
know,
children.
non-consensual is not okay. But yeah, other than that, do whatever.
Yeah, I think if you are thinking things like that, you should be removed from children. I'm a teacher. I work with children. I just can't imagine, you know, especially right now, you know, the mutilation is happening with little children, you know, being brainwashed to be, oh, you can be a dog. And, you know, I know the conversation is not that, but just leave children alone. Children are not, you know, they're not Muslim, in my opinion. Children are just children. They are little humans, you know, just let them be children. And if adults, whatever you want to do, as long as you're not hurting yourself or others, and be you know.
Yeah.
And but it's interesting conversation. Thank you for coming here and sharing your story. And yeah, it's beautiful to see what Yasmin and you know you too, Yasmin, discussed here. I'm glad I'm part of the conversation. And I was kind of saying maybe are the monks you know maybe perhaps better than Momo. Momo is I know Momo is Muhammad, the messenger of prophet, you know, Islamic prophet. So I call him no to Momo. So I said maybe the monks are a little bit better than Momo because Momo was a pedophile, as I don't know if you know much Islam. But thank you for sharing your story and being here.
Thank
And
you.
always no to Momo.
Yeah. Always. Yeah, I think it's definitely a spectrum, Sahara. And that whole spectrum, you know, it changes with time too, right? Depends on who's the powerful, what religion is wielding power at that moment. And but yeah, no, I because you and I have come from an Islamic background that has hurt us personally. I mean, it hurt you physically, you know, with irreparable damage with the female genital mutilation that you spoke to us about when you were on my podcast. I can see obviously how we would find it to be the most deplorable religion in the world today and how it's damaging so many people in the world today. But I think that every religion has the potential of being just as
Absolutely.
dangerous as Islam if it's wielded because it's all irrational bullshit. And if you're going to combine irrational bullshit with power, that's a really dangerous combination.
I think you're right, Yasmin. Any ideas, and I think even sometimes I do criticize atheism, and I don't call myself, I don't know if really, when I had a conversation with you on your podcast, if I talked about, because I don't like labels. I never liked labels, even the Muslim being a Muslim. I just like, I'm Sahara, I'm a human, just leave me alone, don't put me on labels. But atheism also can be a call to that. If you just wanted to raise
100%.
somebody's ideas, I think ideas should be criticized and we should talk about it and we should, you know, discuss things. But if ideas becomes like, do not touch it, then I consider them just like the COVID. I'm sorry. If you can't question something, it is a cult. That's just the way my brain works. And if you don't like it, it's okay. You can just be with you and peace to you know. But I think we should be able to talk about it, things and question. And that's how we grow. We all learning. And by the way, I want to comment. I know you said when you die, you want to be buried under a tree, this, you know, beautiful tree. For me, the same way, I want to be. My ash to be spread, Mother Earth, because I love nature. I love being in nature. It just gives me something that I can't explain. So I want to be in with nature too. And I think I love what you said. You know, death is part of our life, and we should not be, you know, scared or how I know in the religion, of course, you know, you'll be tortured and you have to either be in hell or heaven. But I think when you leave all that. That you know, indoctrination is just it's different. You live every moment, precious moment, and you live to the fullest you can do, you know. So it's just beautiful what you guys talked in here. So thank you. And thanks Thank you for letting me rant always, and love and peace to you all. Thank you.
Love hearing your rants all the time, Sahara. You always have such wonderful things to share with us. And yeah, absolutely. No, no to Momo. Lois.
As always.
Oh, I love you, Sahara.
Love you too, Lois. Love you. Love you all.
A while back, we were talking about, you know, people that we look up to. The human mind is strange. We tend to, instead of delving into the ideas, we almost start to worship the person.
Yeah.
And I think that's something that we have to be careful about. And so I posted in the chat a YouTube video where Seth Andrews interviews a psychiatrist and a neuroscientist, and they talk about why humans tend to do that. And, you know, this whole discussion made me realize how religions seem so different, but yet they have so much in common, everything. And it all boils down to community. And how religions just sort of, I don't know how to describe it, leap on people that are vulnerable. Again, a loss, a death, a divorce. Anytime you're vulnerable, there's the religion to come in and manipulate you because you need community. And I think that's what makes things like your podcast and other organizations that have no sort of central whatever to provide community with no strings attached. So important.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. And I'll add to it too, that religions are good for not having to think. And not just religions. Again, I'll say even secular religions. Yeah. Like even if we're doesn't like we were talking before about libertarians or objection. I forgot what you said. Objectivists or this new woke culture, whatever it is, whatever cult you're a part of, whatever tribe you're a part of, whatever philosophy that you are following, and if you are refusing to think critically about that philosophy and not allowing other people to question it, because then you're going to call them a transphobe or an Islamophobe or a whatever a phobe, then it's actually really comforting for a lot of people. I'd say probably, I don't know, maybe I'm being pessimistic here, but I feel like 80% of this human population just wants to be followers. They just want to be told what to do. So if you're part of a tribe, then you know what to do because the tribe is giving you a rule book and you don't have to think about it, because if you think about it, you might be wrong. And it causes a lot of anxiety to have to try to think about it and see if you're going to get the right answer or not. But if you can just follow X, whatever it is, whatever philosophy, whatever religion, whatever ideology, then it takes that onus off of you. And so I think that goes back to what you were saying, Lois, about almost worshiping the person, because that's what it comes down to. The onus is not on me. It's on this powerful prophet or philosopher or whatever. I trust them. And so I'll just follow whatever they say and I don't have to stress about it. I remember my mom used to always look at the books in libraries and bookstores and be like, oh, look at these kuffar. Look at all these books that they have to read. Look at them trying to figure out life. They only need one book. There's only one book they need to bother reading. And I'm just
Momo's
like,
book. Momo's book.
Momo's book, of course. But like she found comfort in limiting herself and in making herself so tiny, limiting herself to one book. She liked it. It made her happy, made her comfortable, gave her a sense of, you know, path. So I don't
yeah,
know.
But yes, I mean, you, I think you and I and Aliyah and so many of, you know, and Ayan and I think we just didn't fit this tribalism. And I think there are so many people, you know, other religions that just can't fit this group thinking, right? The tribalism, you just want to be individual, because I believe we all individual, unique being, you know, our own ways.
It's tough. It's tough.
Yeah, it is tough though to step out.
Because we're pack animals.
Yes, mm-hmm. Yes. It's hard to step out, and because when you do, then your neck is going to be stepped on, right? The crowd. So, but I think people are just need to be. I get it. You have to be safe. Your safety comes first, but you got to be live your life, and at the end of the day, it's your life, nobody else's life. You know. If you're sick, if you're struggling, it's going to be you. Nobody else is feeding you. You have to pay your bills, and you have to live your life to the truth or whatever your makes you happy. But also you have to be safe, and safety comes first. And I think it takes courage to come out and just say no, and to leave that indoctrination. I mean, we've been brainwashed, even like all other religions, right? But the brainwashing is so deep, even for your mom to, you know, say like, look, the infidels, right? What they read in, but then she doesn't see her own indoctrination, right? Because sadly, she's in the deep, I call it deep in the shit. The shit hole is so deep. She can't realize it, right? Yeah. So I just hope they wake up. It's just, I don't know how you and I and so many of us just kind of, it took a long time and energy and, but to just leave and to indoctrinate yourself, it takes a long time, and it takes time and effort. So, yes, thank you.
We are the rebels.
Yes, absolutely.
We use our mind, we use our rational faculty, and we are not willing to, you know, give me the facts, give me the evidence. You don't have that, then you don't bullshit me.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, Jasmine, I want to give you the last word. Is there anything, any thoughts, any wisdom, any ideas that you want to leave us with before we conclude today?
I don't know. I think at the end of the day, we all have, you know, this rational faculty is what separates, I think, human beings from the rest of the animals, and we have to choose to use it. So I think we should choose to use it. It is effort involved. So it's not like what you're saying, right? You can't follow now blindly. You have to use your mind, your rational faculty, and, you know, come up with your conclusions. And I think so there is no afterlife. And if I'm going to burn in hell, that may that be as it is. I don't care. But life starts when it starts, and life ends when it ends. So make the best of what you have here. And, you know, that's the best way to live a human life, I think. We're just like a part of nature. We're just like all the other things, like you said, the seasons, right? They all go through birth and death. But don't make it this big thing that Jainism has made it. That, oh, you're in the thing of the birth and death, get out of it. No, this is it. You're not going to get another life, only one life to live. So that's all.
Beautiful. Love that. That is a very important message that is difficult for us to remember. But that person you were suggesting to us, Lois, as well, that's a really important lesson, Jasmine. Thank you. If we remember that we only have one life and that it's precious and that it's short, then we won't waste any time, you know, in keeping ourselves in situations that are, you know, unhappy or difficult for us, because we'll value ourselves more than whatever else it is.
I think we got to speak up and be authentic. And thank you. Because, you know, watching some of your videos, what, you know, made me, and then you invited me. So thank you for, you know, giving me this occasion to actually come out in a public forum and talk about it. So very,
thank
very
you.
Thankful about that. Very appreciative, you know, and people like you, Ayan, you know, these are my, like, you know, I was talking to somebody a couple of weeks back, and I said, you know, these are heroes, you know, these are people, like, you know, have stepped out. And I think the more we do that, the more people, hopefully what you said, the 80% will start reducing, and there'll be more people wanting to step out and talk about it and debate. We're not saying, you know, like whatever, you know, use your rational faculty and whatever the answers come out, but at least be willing to shine a light, right? Don't say this is cannot be questioned, no.
Yeah, absolutely agree. So thank you for your bravery today and, you know, for being one of those people that's willing to step out and to share your ideas, even though you know that there's going to be people that are going to react to them. But thank you for your bravery in doing that. I know that that's not difficult, and I appreciate it because, you know, your thoughts and your ideas and your perspectives are really important. And now so many of us are more, you know, educated on this religion and the dangers of it, unfortunately, just like every other religion out there. So thank you, Jasmine, for your time.
Thank you.
And for your honesty in sharing your story with us and your insights as well. All right. Take care, everyone. I'll see you at the next Forgotten
Thank
Feminists.
You. Thank or, you.
No, sorry. At the next Yasmin Muhammad podcast.
Yasmin Muhammad podcast.
Thank you so much.
Yes. Thank you.
Thank you, Nirvana. Take care, everyone. Bye.